Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Sans Pants Radio,
Australia's most biased podcast network.
Hey everyone, welcome to Bookish. I'm George Dimrell. This is a show where we ask you what's your story and what does it say about you. Today on the show we have Sydney, New South Wales born but Melbourne raised comedian, and recently did a show where he won all the stars. Just all the stars, really, wasn't it? Oliver Coleman. How you doing, Oliver?
Very good. Lovely to be here. Thanks for having me, George.
You seemed mildly uncomfortable as I was talking about the reviews and stuff like that.
No, not uncomfortable. I just wanted you to make sure that I was just nervous you weren't going to say that. So when I felt better.
Okay, that's good. I like to make sure my guests feel comfortable very early on. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
That's all right. It's a treat.
It is.
We were just talking before coming on. First time I met you was in Glasgow.
Beautiful, rainy Glasgow. It was at the Stand Comedy Club.
Yeah, that's you were very well known there. I remember being like, oh, fuck, this guy's, because I was packed that night as well. It was like, what was the capacity of the room like that?
Yeah, I reckon well known is a stretch. the Stand is like maybe 300, 250, 300 in Glasgow.
And I love this, just cram them in.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would have been on the Red Raw night, which is like a Tuesday night. They do an open mic night where you you sign up and then a few months later or whatever, you get a spot. Or you can, although it's like comics trying new material and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fun. And they pack it in with students, so it's always a really good vibe.
Yeah, it was such a good vibe. It was just, yeah. You did your 80s, New Yorker guy.
Did I? Yeah, the classic. So it's been going for a few years.
Loved it. I enjoyed it a lot. Yeah, because you were there for a couple of years, right?
Glad I was in Glasgow. So I moved to Glasgow the end of 2016. And then I came back to Australia at the end of 2018.
How is the difference between Glasgow and Melbourne for comedy?
Well, pretty good. I mean, I didn't really start doing much comedy until I kind of got to Glasgow, like gigging a lot. I had done a sketch show with my friend Emil in the 2016 Comedy Festival, and that was kind of the first comedy that I'd done. And then I did like raw comedy that year, and that was my first ever gig. And then had done like a couple and then I did like a solo show at Melbourne Fringe in 2016 after having done like, four gigs or something.
Nice. But love that. Love it.
That was more like there was less stand-up. I mean, not that I just do stand-up these days, but it was like more like theatery and characters and stuff. And then I'd done like a couple of, like I might have done like one night at the Imperial Open Mic and then like a spot at the Wild or something before moving to Glasgow. And so I was only really in Glasgow that I started like gigging a lot and doing lots of comedy. Mm. But before that I was like acting and doing theatre and stuff.
Yeah, so that's what led you into it. And what's the scene like though in Glasgow compared to Melbourne for someone who's like just trying to work on it? Is it good or is it bad or is it better, same, different?
It's good. I mean, like the fact that you can go to the Stand, I mean, it takes a while to get a spot and like perform in front of like a huge crowd when you're like just starting out is great. And there's other clubs like Monkey Barrel in Edinburgh, And then there's another stand in Edinburgh. So, like, the nature of this, I mean, it's just like the UK is just like a great place to do comedy because there's like, one, there's more of a pathway towards making it like a feasible economic reality just because there's like large population centers close to each other that have like working comedy clubs, you know, throughout the week, every weekend. Like a city like Glasgow has like, I don't know, like a quarter of the population of Melbourne or something. And there's like, you know, a bunch of like weekend comedy clubs that people go to. And then there's Edinburgh like 40 minutes away, which has the same thing.
Yeah. People don't realize how close it's weirdly close. Edinburgh and Glasgow, like 40 minutes.
Yeah. So close. And then there's just like a culture of like going to stuff. So it's like, yeah, it's great. I mean, there's probably, I would say maybe you can get up between Glasgow and Glasgow, maybe like if you're like just starting out like a little less than you would in Melbourne, but usually the gigs are better quality.
More than three people? What do you mean?
Yeah. But, you know, yeah. I would say that's the difference. And also, yeah, I mean, it's also, there's like a Glasgow's, you know, it's, what was, yep.
You're not feeling very relaxed. Feeling stressed. I was just asking if the scenes were different. So yes, you've answered.
Oh, the scenes are different, man. Yeah, the scenes are different. They're different. What else do you want to know?
I feel like I was putting you under the.
Oh my god! Enough with these questions. Oh, I feel attacked right now. Jesus, I come on this podcast, you start asking me questions.
I'm sorry, man. I didn't think about it, all right?
Take a step back.
I'm taking a step back. I was out of line. Yeah, thank you for letting me know.
I'm sorry.
asking basic what was your question. Time like? And actually, yes, I do got to mention this. So just quickly, because your style of comedy is... it's fun. It's different, I feel, from a lot of people. When people ask you, oh, what do you like, do you ever actually have a ready answer for that or do you not have an answer?
What am I like as a comedian? I say generally I do like absurdist, silly stuff, sometimes like character stuff, more theatrical stuff. But the stuff I've been doing lately is like the stuff I've been writing lately this year is more kind of straight stand-up than I've done before.
Really?
In terms of like, it's not really very joke heavy. It's funny.
Classic
it's,
Coleman.
It's funny. But it's more like about creating like a vibe in the room or something as opposed to just like observational stuff.
Okay. You know? All right. Yeah. That's fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'd love seeing you. Yeah. And you, like I said, you cleared out all the stars during your run this year. Blake.
So I did a show with Blake Everett called Blake Everett and Oliver Coleman Dig Their Own Graves about two struggling shovel salesmen on the run from the Russian mob. Doing a show about two struggling shovel salesmen on the run from the Russian mob. Yeah, and it was good. We got some good reviews, which was nice. Sold out most of the shows. I mean, it was a good year for a lot of people at the comedy festival because none of the international acts were here.
True, so. No competition. It's great.
It was great. Keep COVID going.
Keep it going. Yes. Monopoly. Yeah. So, So that's, I love seeing it. But so we'll go into more about you, I guess. But let's start with the book. You've picked an interesting one. Okay. So what your book of choice for today is?
Yeah. So I chose The Savage Detectives by Roberto Bolaño, Chilean author.
And do you want to give some I didn't know it, so I've only done some very cursory research into it. But basically, it looks quite strange in terms of how it's designed and what it's about.
Yeah, it is strange. I mean, I was trying to think of a book to think about, and I read a bit, but no books have really. I don't know. This was just the last book I read, and I read it years ago. That like I don't know. I felt like had an impact or something when I read it, or it just like stayed with me or something.
Okay.
Not that I remember a lot of detail about it, but I just remember.
Oh, having... This has been a roller coaster already. It's just, I read a lot, but I didn't read this for a few years ago, and that's it.
And I've forgotten it all. But yeah. No. I just remember having a strong, like, emotional connection or something. What's it about? It's about a group of young poets. It's kind of broken into three sections or whatever, Yeah, it's broken into like three sections. It's about a group of young poets in Mexico City called, they call themselves like the Visceral Realists. And I think that the first section's like set in the 70s or whatever. And so the first section is these like teenagers or like people in their early 20s who are trying to like live this kind of bohemian life. And they're searching for this kind of like mythic figure who's like the person who started the Visceral Realists, this like kind of strange unknown poet back in the 20s. And then the first like section is just about their kind of like fun bohemian life kind of in Mexico City. And the second section is from the perspective of like a whole bunch of different narrators. I think there's like 40 different voices or something who are talking about some of the figures in the earlier section. The Roberto Bolaño has an alter ego called Arturo Bolaño, who is kind of his figure, which is in that book and then also in a bunch of other books. And then the last section is what happens in the last section? I think the last section is them trying to finally find that kind of mythic poet person who started the Visceral Realists.
So like the second section is a bunch of people almost like a like when a documentary films a bunch of people about, oh, what do you think of when this guy was coming through? Like, is it kind of like that? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. It's them kind of reporting on their like minor interactions with these people, or maybe it'll go down like just like talk about some random stuff for a while that happened to like some random figure, and then one of these people like pop up just like in a bar or something whilst it spent 30 pages talking about just this person's life.
It's so odd. It's a different book. Do you like the kind of more stuff like that?
Yeah. I mean, I like...
It just doesn't seem... You seem confused. Like, it just doesn't seem to be a classic narrative structure. It seems to be...
Yeah, it's not a classic narrative structure. Yeah. I feel like often when I read, I'm not, like, super into, like, plot and narrative. Often it's like...
Anyone seen your comedy?
It doesn't make sense. No, it's more like the experience or something of reading it. I think the reason I like this book, I probably read it in my late 20s or something, and I remember reading like a book like on the road or something in my like late teens or whatever, early 20s. I feel like that's such like a touchstone of like being like a teenage boy or whatever. Like it's such that like book that you read when you're like, oh, I want to like do art or like get into comedy or whatever, those sorts of things. But it's a really like, I feel like On the Road is something that's like quite like romanticized and like, that like bohemian artistic kind of life is idealized kind of. And then I like The Savage Detectives because the first section of the book is like that. And then the second section and the third section are kind of like the aftermath of that, where everyone's kind of like drifted into obscurity and their lives have fallen to shit.
They're just the worst.
Yeah. Or they're like just alcoholics and that sort of thing. And I think it's like great because it like captures that like energy and like passion and of youth and like someone who wants to like make art or whatever, and then it also like follows that and sees what happens.
Shows you where it goes.
Yeah. But it never like it's not like cynical or whatever, and it doesn't like discount the like the value of like that kind of life. But
it is giving you the full picture.
It gives you the full picture.
Yeah, you're like, why didn't anyone tell me this on the road? All right.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, and like that's what happened to like, Kerouac or whatever, like he did on the road, and then he became like an alcoholic, and like his later books are like, you know, yeah, his life sucked after that. He was very unhappy. And I feel like this book kind of captures all of that in one. And it's also like very playful and fun. Something that I like in fictions and that sort of thing is like one is like the use of like false narrators or like false like realities and that sort of thing. And it's fun.
False as in like the person's lying or false as in like just the world's made up? Like, what do you mean exactly?
Like where you can't tell what's real and what's fake.
Oh, okay.
Like, because like Arturo Bolaño is like, the name is very close to Roberto Bolaño. So you don't know how much of this aligns with like his life and his kind of, because he was young as a poet in Mexico City as well. And like the I can't remember the name of the city, but the city is kind of like a made up city in Mexico. It's called like Santa Teresa or thing, but it's based on a real city, but he's given it a different name. So all of there's something fun. I'm not quite sure what it is about, like the creation of like the like play between what's real and what's fake.
Mm. And is it like sometimes, because I haven't read it, does it take it to like extremes where it's very obvious, or is it usually actually quite dancing in that could be real, could be not, or some of the characters just completely outrageous as well?
Some of them are completely outrageous as well. And like it plays in like genre and stuff. Like he's got all these like, yeah, like in like his other books, and like his characters go from like books to books, like they're in different books.
Well, how much have you read of this guy?
Yeah, he's got some other great books. Like he's got this other awesome book called Distanced. I like fictions about fictions. Like he's got this other book called The Nazi Literature of Latin America, where it's just it's kind of like a fake reference book, where it's just descriptions of different fascist authors in Latin America. And I really enjoy, there's something about like reading like false biographies and that sort of thing.
And it's meant to be funny?
It's playful,
yeah.
You know, it's playful. It's playful. Like he's got this book called Distant Star, which is about this fascist Chilean poet who is also a pilot and writes, like, skywrites fascist poetry in the sky. And I guess all of, like, I don't know much, but I guess all of that's related to, like, the fascism of, like, the Pinochet era or whatever in Chile and stuff. And then, like, those other books, like the Borges, the Jorge Luis Borges, like, his books, I like his stories where they're, like made up stories about other books. He's got that where it's like a made up reference book about a whole kind of mythic place, like world. Yeah, I like fictions about fictions. And I think, yeah.
So is that like, my depth of Latin American reading is probably actually quite slim. seem to have a few. Is that like something you like that area? Is that something that's distinct, or is it just that just happens to be what you're referencing right now?
I think it just happens to be what I'm referencing right now.
Right.
They're related to him.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Yeah. Because I've read any of
and that's probably Borges. The extent of my reading.
After that, I'm done.
I'm done.
You're going to know some fairly fancy Latin American authors, and then that's it. The street cred is already established.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the idea of the meta analysis of stuff, right? That's what you're talking about, yeah. Did you like that? Like across, did you always like that, or is that something you developed over time, or is this kind of like this is almost too obviously playing into what I've seen of you in terms of what you do on stage and stuff like that. You seem to like playing with conventions and playing around with like talking about the thing you're doing and stuff like that.
Yeah, a little bit. Like at the moment, the stand up that I'm running is kind of like comedy about doing comedy, kind of.
Yeah.
Which sounds awful. But I think I've managed to make it interesting and funny.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, I mean, that sounds awful as well. Like it's a book about a bunch of poets searching for a poet, but it's done in like a really playful kind of fun way.
Yeah, see, that side of it as well, because that's something you bring to the stage, I guess I should say, like the playfulness.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just weird that like it's just perfectly slots and says like, did you pick this because of that, or is that a connection that's just like there?
I think so. I think it's like something that I think about, and also like I enjoy, like sometimes the conventions of comedy of stand up is that it's like I think the audience is trained to think of it as like an autobiographical kind of performance or whatever, and it's about kind of self-revelation and truth and that sort of thing. And so I think it's fun if you can play with those expectations and see how you can like undermine them. Like it's enjoyable to like see how you can weave in like false biography and that sort of thing.
All right, so yeah, you go out of your way to like not go out of your way, but that's you actually write with that intent in mind a little bit.
Yeah, sometimes, yeah. Well, like, I think it's like a...
That sounds good.
Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, like what you say, George. Yeah, I'm doing that. I'm going to do that now. But I think there's like other, like I find it interesting those people who do that, like that newest Bob Dylan documentary where it follows him on the Rolling Thunder tour. Oh, have you watched it?
No.
It's funny because it's like it's got interviews with him and interviews with a whole bunch of other like famous people, and it seems like a totally legit documentary until you like start realizing that it's just like all horseshit and totally made up. And they've got like Sharon Stone in it talking about how she was like friends with Penny Baker and that sort of thing, was like there on the road making the concert with them. And it's just like, I think it's interesting, that idea of like a person creating their own story that,
yeah,
that isn't related to reality.
Yeah, yeah. Like as in it's always like, yeah, it's interesting doing that. This is a tangent now, but the fictional, okay, most obvious version of this ever, people who make up stage names.
Yeah.
I'm always like, how do you come up with a stage name that you're going to be happy with forever? It's so hard. So I'm always impressed with people who like, when you hear the good ones as well, like Elton John, you're like, oh, that's such a good stage name.
Yeah. I find it incredible. I couldn't, and now I feel like Oliver Coleman, like I'm lumped with this name. Like it's.
I think it's all right, Oliver Coleman.
It's fine, but it's like, it's cumbersome. To say there's too many syllables. It's too close to like Olivia Coleman.
That's not a bad association though.
Yeah, but you don't want to be associated with someone who's like doing much better than you.
There's enough of a gap, I think. That's right. Maybe, yeah.
But yeah, I find
that George Dimerelis has none of those problems.
George Dimerelis is great. That's like a bow.
I don't think so. All right, so to go back to the book for a second, actually, in terms of that, you're talking about how like the difference was you read The Road, and that's, I'm sure, just an example of when you're younger, and then you see this version when you're older, and you get this bit more perspective on how it all works. Did that, reading The Road back then, have an impact on you?
Do you reckon? The Road? Yeah. Yeah, I think so. It was like, I remember, I probably read it in like year 11 or year 12 or something, when you're reading like kind of the boring books that you have to at school. And then that seemed, I think maybe my English teacher or something recommended it. And it was cool because it was like a group of like people getting together who wanted to make art and, you know, be in the world in like an interesting way. I think so, yeah. I mean, I feel like a book like that is like, seems like hack and like,
and it's
totally trite and cliche now, and also
and
like
so problematic as well.
Yeah, the politics of it are not good now.
Because Bruce, the main character, doesn't really create anything; he just kind of lives, doesn't he?
He just cruises. Yeah. And I think that's like over time. I read it again in my 20s, and I felt less affection for it. One, because like Kerouac is like not particularly like political in a way that like other people like Ginsberg or something were. From like the beat stuff, and then yeah, also all like the politics of it, all the gender politics and that sort of thing are bad now. Yeah, so it did have an impact. It was like one of the first books that I read that I was like, oh, cool, this is like a book that speaks to me or something.
So a friend, like you're like, yeah, I just want to not kick back, but I just want to do what I want to do. I don't want to go be part of the machine, man, like that sort of thing.
Yeah, but then, you know, I went and joined the machine anyway. So.
Oh, really? Which machine did you join? What did you
join? No, just go to uni and that sort of thing. Anyway. Oh.
Yeah. We can't get out of the machine. That's what you mean.
I know.
But you were, but you always had a passion for like acting and theater and stuff like that?
Yeah, I used to do it at school, and then I went to uni and I studied law for a while.
Okay.
And then
machine, yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Making more sense, yeah.
But then whilst I was at uni, I started doing like heaps of student theatre and stuff and kind of got sucked into that and ended up doing more of that than like going to lectures and that sort of thing.
All right. So you're just like, fuck it, I'm just going to do this now.
Yeah, but then I dropped out. I dropped out of law school and went to acting school.
All right. And then you did that for a bit and then started with the comedy stuff. Comedy's good because at least you can like perform your own stuff faster, I guess.
The overheads are lower than theatre. It's good.
Well, you do pack in a lot of props.
The economics stack up.
Yeah. I'm not an economist, but this makes sense.
Yeah. No, it is. I mean, yeah, that's like the hard thing about like theater and acting. It takes a lot more to get stuff on. Whereas like comedy, you can feel like you're like constantly working because you have an idea and you can go.
Yeah.
Do it in an open mic night that night or whatever.
And did you like always like write stuff as well? Or was that a thing that developed with you looking at comedy and stuff?
Yeah. I mean, when I was like at acting school, like my aspirations were always to be like a theater maker person. Like it was never really, I mean, if Hollywood came calling, I'd pick up the phone. But, you know,
I'd let it ring a few times first.
Yeah. But I think my aspirations towards that were always like fairly realistic. What I wanted to do was like make theater. And then I never really did that in the years kind of just after drama school until I started doing comedy. Cause I was like, I could never really like think of the project that I wanted to make. And, the sort of theater that I liked, I never had the self-confidence to make. Like I liked stuff that was like boring and like experimental and challenging, where it would be someone like, someone I liked to watch was like someone like standing on stage, like boiling the kettle, and you're like, just like sit there and watch them boil the kettle for 4 minutes.
What?
But I was never going to make work like that because I would just assume that the audience would find it boring and walk out. So then I started.
How much of that is confidence and just self-involvement? We're like, you just watch.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So then I don't know. I just, and then for some reason, I actually can't like pinpoint the what actually got me into doing comedy. Like I remember as a teenager, I'd listen to like Bill Hicks or like you watch those like Eddie Murphy specials or whatever. Mm. I remember having like a Rodney Rood CD that I liked back in the day. But that I like as a teenager, but then it wasn't until I was like 25 or something that I started like actually, I think when I was doing the, like a play in the Fringe Festival and I used my pass to go see a bunch of stand-up. I think I was watching like a bunch of like, I don't know, for some reason I got into watching Stuart Lee somehow and was watching a bunch of that.
Classic.
Yeah, and that really clicked with me. And then got into it that way.
All right. And then just been kicking goals since, right?
It's been slam dunk after slam dunk. Oh, baby.
When have you had, so just because, again, I do know your stuff can be quite interesting. So have you had situations where the audience just completely not with it and you're just got it and you just keep doing your bit and you're like, this sucks so bad?
Yeah, I've bombed. I've had some good, yeah, I've had some bad bombs.
That's the thing, you would have some almost glorious bombs with like what you do, which is almost makes it fun again in a weird way. Yeah,
I mean like that New York guy, generally I do like a 80s New York comedian character and he generally does like well. But then I remember one night, like I was doing like a tent at Adelaide Fringe and that was like also like a big night. It was like 300 people or something and I was doing it and it's like a 5 minute bit. Like it goes for a long time.
Yeah.
And it was like silent. For most of it. Someone even shouted out, they go, "What's going on?"
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Yes. That's so good.
Oh, it's awful. Serious? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's amazing. Someone actually shouted it out.
Yeah.
Look, it goes, you start off, yes, doing the, it goes weird. It does go from memory. It does go a bit strange.
Yeah.
Can't just keep it to this just generic, hey, yeah, you have to go.
Yeah.
It's part of what makes it fun. But yeah, that actually, that's to tie it back in as well. Like, as in, because you always, you do add that extra layer of character to what you're doing. You don't just sit on the cliches. You always seem to add in a bit more to what's being done, right? And is that, again, an intentional thing, or is that just something you just naturally do?
I think so. I think I try and add like a little extra element to whatever. Like that 80s comedian ends up going to it where there's like a multiple dialogue between different, like a husband and wife in a in a New York apartment.
It does, yeah. It gets strange. But yeah, I guess because like I'm just tying it back to the book again, like as in the because it's a character, like you like the characters, you like the fake biographies. It sounds like you just like that element, right? Like fleshing that out a bit more than just sitting on a cliche. That's what I meant when I was saying that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
I guess we should go back to the book more. Okay. No, because you're, so to go back to the book, I guess, you like reading in general.
Yeah, I'm one of those people who goes through like phases. Like I'll read kind of a lot and then not read a book for a few months or something.
All right. Okay.
I'm not like consistently reading.
That's right.
Yeah. If I don't, it's something like there's a good, I sometimes I find it hard to sit down and read and I feel like I'm referencing all the like the cliche people like Kerouac and David Foster Wallace and that sort of thing. But there's a good.
Don't worry, bro.
There's a good interview with David Foster Wallace.
You're definitely a type of dude, though.
I'm definitely, yeah. I'm exactly. At least I know who I am.
Yeah. From Kerouac. Now I'm going to talk about David Foster.
Oh, he's a wanker. Oh, I get it. Oh, good. No, I've never not read Infinite Jest. But there's an interview with him on YouTube where he talks about why Americans don't read more, and he says that there's like. It's such like a silent activity as opposed to like watching TV or like doing other things where there's like noise and it like fills the space a bit more.
Mm.
But like when you're like sitting in a room and reading a book and you're alone, it's like it's like quiet and lonely. And he talks about this like dread that sits in and that like falls when you like sit down in like because you're just with yourself in the quiet. And it's like, you get filled with existential dread.
Oh my sometimes. God.
That's what he describes. It's not like an intense experience, but it's like hard. Like, it's much easier to, like, you know, switch on a screen or something where, like, where you're like connecting with an outside thing and it's not just yourself.
Yeah, I never actually thought about that. You've blown my mind because that's a concept I never actually, I know. Technically, David Foster Wallace has blown my mind, but you channeling his words to me has blown my mind. Because I never thought about that. It's very true. Because like, I always thought of like reading the issue is just the effort required. Like, as in, you can just passively sit and watch TV. You don't have to do anything. But with reading, you actually have to think.
Yes.
But I never thought about the element of like just the emptiness.
Yeah.
The silence. And just like, you're just sitting there and like, yeah, there's nothing. Yeah.
Yes.
I wonder if you've just ruined reading for me forever.
I hope so. This is the last episode of the podcast.
I've read a bit.
Yeah. But I guess that's also why it's rewarding, right? Because you're forced to like overcome that.
Just, I never even thought it was the thing to overcome.
And then like you have to sit there with your own thoughts and you think more and you come to something through that experience of overcoming that dread and alienation.
This is grim. Okay. So basically you go through bouts where you read until the dread gets too much and then you're like, I need a break.
Yeah. And then
I need some colors. Yeah. Yeah. Where's some cartoons?
Yeah.
Okay. That's but yeah. Never heard that before.
Yeah. I connected with that.
On a deep level, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's all right. Yeah, just because I want to know what kind of informed, because like I've had a few people on who do like the more I'm going to say meta sort of stuff, which I guess yours is kind of that. Was you're saying you kind of like that stuff, or it's about
the act of doing it. Is that what you?
Yeah, I think so. I like some meta stuff. Yeah, yeah, medium. I mean, I also like reading. Not everything I read is heavy. Like, I like reading light books. I like reading books by comedians.
Best book by a comedian?
I read. That's not like a light. I read The Prettiest Horse in the Glue Factory. Which is Corey Whitehead's like biography
about
him growing up in foster care and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great book. Very interesting. I'm studying social work, so I was kind of interested in that as well, like just like the foster care system and that sort of thing.
Okay. With this book here, right? You said you read it in your late 20s?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you had a bit more experience under your belt and you're like, I wanted to see a more holistic picture of what this kind of lifestyle is, not necessarily the negative, but, you know, just to see it bigger. Did you feel like that was more, did you like it just because, I'm guessing it didn't reframe anything because you'd lived it. So you knew the more realistic picture of what that lifestyle kind of led to. So was it just nice to see it kind of put into fiction?
Yeah. I don't know if it like revealed anything great to me, but it's like fun. It's interesting to see like, because there's so many of those books where it's like, you know, young man as an artist, you know, Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man or On the Road or all those kind of young man, young person wanting to be a artist books and those like bohemian life books. But this one kind of was that and then it was something else and it became, it was just done in a much more kind of complicated, playful, fun way, you know.
Yeah, no, sounds.
Yeah.
I really thought you were going to add more then.
I thought I was going to add more. Then there was nothing more to add.
So, and the writing in it was quite playful, as you mentioned as well. To go over the writing stuff, because actually I don't ask enough comedians this. Do you sit down and write?
Yes, I do.
Word for word.
Yeah, I do sit down. I sit down and write it word for word. Generally, I'd like to get to a point where I wasn't doing that because sometimes I feel like I'm aiming. Like my aim is to be much kind of looser and improvisatory. I want to improvise more on stage, much looser on stage and more dynamic. Where you can kind of react to whatever's happening in the room. And so I think with like an hour show, I can tend to do that because you've got like the playfulness and you've got time within that. When you're doing like shorter bits or like comedy nights, it's a little bit harder if you're like testing it. You're like, oh, I've got this 7-minute bit to test out. I've got 7 minutes. So I'll just do this and steamroll through whatever happens in the room.
Right, and so you'll actually write 7 minutes, like the full 7 minutes will be mapped out basically.
Sometimes, yeah, I tend to write like longer bits, like 5 minutes or
right. Because yeah, it's just this actually surprised me, just because of like I said, it's character based and it's quite wild what you do up there. I always thought that improvisation would be a big part of it from the start, but you're saying actually you write out.
Well, how like it's gonna go. So, I tend to write it out, and then I won't have learnt it well enough, so I'll have to improvise the first few times I do it, and then And then usually by then I kind of know it well enough that I can kind of play a little bit more with it.
Mm.
But yeah, it is quite written.
Right,
but I suppose, yeah. My aim is to have it not seem that way.
Well, you're succeeding. That's all right. Yeah. That's good. But because like, yeah, in terms of just the joke structure and stuff, because do you just sit there and be like, and like write it out like that? Like as in... You just kind of – do you get the voice in your head or the idea of what you want to do? Like where do you start with it, I guess? Blank page.
You know, generally I feel like writing comedy is like frustrating, I feel, because I feel like your best things just come out almost fully formed, you know? Like that New York guy is like a really bankable bit or whatever that I have. Except for that one time in LA. He's like a good bit. And I reckon.
What is happening?
What the fuck?
It's amazing, man.
Wait, this is my good stuff, guys.
This is my killer material, guys.
But yeah, like that would have come out, I reckon. I would have just sat there and wrote it pretty much word for word, almost word for word, as I do it now, like in like an hour and a half or something.
Really?
Yeah. Whereas other times, it's like you'll have an idea and you'll plug away and you'll do it at like 10 gigs and it like gets a bit better, but it's never like, it's never as good as the stuff that just comes out in like one chunk.
Really?
It just pours out of you.
I do feel like that's kind of true, just because like, well, but you can't, you have to do the grinding to try to get that stuff, which does come out naturally, right?
Yes, exactly right. And I think I've gotten better at like just sitting down and writing. And I have noticed that like once you start writing, other ideas happen or they'll lead to make you to think of something else, or like you can take this one bit and put it somewhere else.
Mm.
So, yeah, I think it's only really been this year where where I've been able to sit down, and sometimes I'll just like write, like brainstorm at this top of the page or something, and then I'll just like write.
And so much of it you get rid of, right?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah, just like pads that you get rid of. Yeah.
Pads, whole pads, you're just like...
Not really, yeah.
So you do freehand writing?
Yeah, I sometimes, yeah, I feel like I tend to write with a pen and pad because it's more work and so you write less. So I feel like laughs, you get to the punchline or something faster when you write with a pen, whereas if you're at a computer, it's easier to type so you can be...
You just keep going,
you know? Yeah.
Yeah.
But I feel like you're more efficient when you write with a pen and paper. And I like with a pen and paper, you can like write something and then you've got like a page there and you can like cross stuff out and write something above what you crossed out. And so you can see what was there before and what you've edited it to.
Mm.
It's more like, yeah, it allows
more freedom, you know?
I love this switch to self-conscious. You're doing all right, and you're like, no, it's lame anyway. So David Foster Wallace would say, the pen is mightier than the... did you feel like when... So, again, I'm just... it's something which I haven't heard before in terms of the angle of this book, going with the Bohemian stuff to then showing the aftermath almost. Did you feel like you, like... I definitely went in with a naive perspective on what was required in the industry to get anywhere. Did you notice that as well when you went in, or were you a bit more realistic about it? Are you still in denial about elements of it in terms of the comedy career? The arts, actually, I should say more generally.
I feel like I don't think I was ever like naive. Like I remember being at drama school and thinking – I'll probably have to work like other casual jobs for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
To do what I want to do. And at that point I was like, oh, I want to make like experimental independent theater.
Boil some kettles.
Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, that's what I'll do.
Oh, so that was actually a realistic thing you.
Yeah. But the reality of doing that is different, and whether or not that's like sustainable. And it's much hard. It's hard. And I finished drama school in like 2013. So it's been like 8 years. And there's been like enough progression for me where I've like kept doing it each year. And I've like developed as like a maker of stuff enough that I've kept myself interested in what I'm making. I think your like ideas about like success or whatever shift. I mean what are we talking about in terms of like success? Like the idea is to like pay your rent, I think. It's like a financial thing. Like pay your rent from your art, I think.
Yeah. I mean, well that's part of the question, I suppose. Like, is that what you reckon?
I mean, yeah, that's I'd like to do that. I'd like to be able to pay my rent by just making art.
But the reason I'm saying is because it sounds like when you first started out, at least, you were like, I'm not going to be able to pay my rent and I don't care because I'm going to be creating stuff.
Yeah. I was like, oh, well, that's just the way it'll be. But then, like, it's exhausting. Like, it's exhausting working other jobs and then, like, doing comedy and stuff as well. Like, it's
wild.
It's a lot. And it's like, it gets harder as you go along. Like, it's easier when you're 25 than it is when you're 32, and I imagine it's only going to get
harder. Yeah, just tiring wise. Harder, yeah.
More. I'm only going to get more tired as I get old.
It's got grim.
Yeah. But yeah, that's good.
Well, I guess, like, because now you mentioned it, it's something I like. Yeah, so your measure of, you always wanted to be creative. Like, this was obviously, comedy isn't an avenue to make money unless you get super successful, but you were like literally not even, that was deep secondary, any of that, to you being creative, to you creating stuff, to you pushing boundaries, all that sort of thing. Is that right? Pushing boundaries.
Yeah, but
like,
I mean,
I love Kerouac and pushing boundaries.
Yeah, but I know, I always wanted, yeah, I think so. But like, I mean, still you hope that, yeah, like, yeah, you're do well enough or that enough people like what you do that they pay for it and you can pay your rent doing it. Mm. And we'll see how we go. But, you know, maybe we'll get there eventually.
This might be your last episode.
my last episode.
This has gotten a little bit grim. No, that's true. It's just interesting, that attitude, I guess, because, like, I don't know. I probably didn't think about it, any of it, enough going in, some of it, but I was just like,
fool.
But the other, I guess the other only stuff I was going to say, this could be just a 2 second thing. With the false history stuff we were talking about before, right? The false narrative and stuff like that. Do you, and I realize I kind of touched on it with the Elton John thing a little bit. Do you reckon your history is boring?
Yeah, that's interesting. Like, a little bit, like, it's kind of just like, like a normal childhood in the suburbs or whatever. Yeah, a little bit. And that's funny because, like, a lot of the people, like Bob Dylan, had like a similar kind of upbringing, I suppose. And then he's created this like false history or whatever for himself. Yeah, yeah, a little. Like, I mean, it's a little bit boring, but it's also like not necessarily what I find. Like, I feel like what I can bring to like making stuff is, or like, isn't like necessarily like my own, like just reporting my own experience. It's kind of like how I see the world, or like how I, what I come up with, as opposed to like necessarily just kind of reporting what's happened to me.
Oh yeah, definitely not. Yeah. Especially, yeah, as a generic, white straight dude experience.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Sadly, that's been won by the guys you've referenced have already done that.
Yeah, they've done a great job.
Damn it.
But no, like, there's something about like just that trick of like a false narrative or a false documentary. I remember when I was a little kid and I watched this documentary on TV about how they had faked the moon landing. And it was just like, I randomly turned it on in the middle of the day on like SBS. And it went like detail for detail about how the moon landing was faked. And it was amazing because they'd interviewed like, and they must have given them a script and stuff. They interviewed like people like Donald Rumsfeld, who was like working with Kennedy at the time. Someone, I don't know, Nixon, I think. Yeah. And like Colin Powell, and like they interviewed like Stanley Kubrick's wife, and she was saying that Stanley Kubrick had like filmed the fake moon landing. And I was like watching this going like, is this just on TV in the middle of the day? How is this not like headline news?
Yeah.
This documentary is saying they faked the moon landing. And then it wasn't until the end that I like finished watching it and I was like, oh, whoa. And then I like was like, oh, whoa, it's April Fool's Day today. And I feel like it was just, it's like, it was amazing. And I loved like being sucked in by that.
Yeah.
And then that like revelation. I didn't feel cheated when it got revealed to me that the moon landing was real and the documentary was fake. But it was like, it was just that.
You're a rare case of conspiracy theorist if you're saying that.
Yeah, it was a fun, it was a fun game. I think it's a fun game to play with an audience. Yeah.
Yeah, like that imagination sort of like, yeah. Because you're having fun during it.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it's not necessary to have the moon landing be fake.
Yes, yeah, yeah, exactly right. Yeah. It's like, yeah.
Yeah, that is fun.
Here's what else I like about the book. I like books that have a lot of description, like particular detail about things, like, or even just like talking to people. Like, it's fun. Like, I don't know anything about footy, but I love talking to people who know a lot about footy and are really into it. It's just fun hearing stuff explained in detail by people who are passionate about it.
Cool. Well, we've kind of seemed to have jumped around, I think. We've built a picture of why you like the book. Do you have any – actually, I always do like to ask at the end of the show. Do you feel like you have any new outlook on the Savage Detectives and yourself after this podcast?
No, not really. I have read it quite a few years ago, so I feel like I'd like to go back and reread it. I feel like it would be a book that would reward rereading. And I wonder if I'd have – if I went back and read it again, if I'd have any affection for it. Maybe I wouldn't like it.
Great way to end the show. Okay, well, that's thank you very much for being on, and I guess we'll leave it there.
Hey, man, thanks for having me.
Oh, also, would you like to give a plug to anything while you're here, whether it's online content or blah blah blah?
Yeah, sure. Blake Everett and I are doing our show again at Melbourne Fringe. That will be in October. Come to that. It's called Blake Everett and Oliver Coleman Dig Their Own Graves.
Okay. Yeah, it's a great show. Very well worth checking out.
Thanks, man.
No worries. And I'll give some links to your own socials and stuff in the description. Oh,
my God. Thank you so much.
George, you're welcome. Thank you. It's okay.
It's lovely.
That's just for you, not for everyone.
Wow. Wow.
Well, thanks for being on.
Thanks for listening. If you want to help support this show and all the other shows we do here at Sans Pants Radio, then why not subscribe to SansPantsPlus.com? For as little as $5 a month, you could have access to a whole bunch of bonus shows and content. Once again, that's SansPantsPlus.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.